Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. I'm Jacob Birch. Eric Steven is here. Nothing happened in baseball this past couple of weeks. It's so January. Nothing happens in baseball in January.
All I know is the MLB All-Star Game is at Dodger Stadium this July for the first time in 40 years.
Arbitration numbers deadline passed, so that's a little bit of news, I guess.
But we don't know who's going to manage the American League All-Stars this year. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. And that's, we'll talk about why, and I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you know why, but we'll go into, like, how a Dodger fan is reacting, how we're reacting, what we think about it. And then a little bit of off-season news. The old friend has returned to the team. We have a Dodger Rewind I'm personally very excited about. And as always, questions from Craig. All that after this.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
This has to be the biggest baseball story to break in January in a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, like we were talking about this, like, last year, like, the two biggest, like, signings were...
Yeah, that took
they didn't happen until February or, like, late, you know. So, like, the funny part about this, like, we always talk about this. We sometimes struggle with a topic every week, especially in the off season when, like,
especially January and February, like, right before spring training gets going in earnest. But after, you know, with last year accepting all of the big free agent names have kind of been off the board, that lull, we can do one kind of like spring training preview episode, but we can only do that once.
Yeah. So like we go every 2 weeks now in the off season with the caveat of, hey, if something big happens, we'll do an emergency pod. We have not done an emergency pod. So, like, this episode was going to be about salary arbitration, because that's, like, it's relevant in a weird way, and we'll get to it later. But then, an old friend's back, and again, we'll get to that later. But then, like, oh, okay, the hammer came down for the Astros. So, like, the MLB released their, like, report based on investigation into the Astros, electronic sign stealing, and... they got, like, pretty significantly dinged, right? Like, there's a lot of things about this that was, like, significant. My favorite part is in the report, the phrase banging scheme appears 8 different times, which is just wonderful. The whole point about this is, like, teams have stolen signs for years. They generally do it with their eyes. But, like, anytime you sort of use technology and ways to electronics to sort of skirt or make things more efficient or quicker, I think that's where you sort of lose the sense of competition in it all. Like, or I don't know, maybe it's not true competition or whatever. And that's where, like, MLB is trying to crack down on. And, like, they did a pretty thorough, like, interview or investigation on this, but really only after Mike Fiers put his name on record with The Athletic in November, because, like, MLB has sort of dismissed this in the past. You know, they're like, we didn't really find anything. And it really took Mike Fiers, like, coming out for them to finally go, you know what, MLB is very reactionary. Like, we have to sort of, this is bad PR. We have to, okay, we'll figure this out. They interviewed 68 people, including 23 current and former Astros. So lots of people who are directly involved. The bottom line is this: the Astros were fine $5 million, which is laughably low, but it's the maximum allowed by the MLB Constitution. I don't see any way this ever gets changed. Like, a real fine would have been at least $50 million. Like, it's a fine where it makes an owner go, holy shit, like, I don't ever want to pay this again. It would make them actually change. Now it just seems like, oh, $5 million bucks, that's it? While we're sitting there in, you know, in the afterglow of our first World Series championship. Like, well,
and the other thing is, it could be self-policing if, you know, yes, players had been disciplined at all.
Right, and then, so that's the thing. So they got 23 players to talk, and I don't think that this has been, like, official yet, but it's pretty clear that, like, MLB, like, offered immunity as for, to the players to talk, because otherwise I don't think they would have talked. And if the players didn't talk, MLB, I don't know how much info they actually had. So that's sort of a weird angle to this. But, yeah, so the big things, the measurable things the Astros lost, they lost first and second round picks, this draft and next draft, and then, like, there's a caveat where if the Astros sign somebody and lose a first round pick, like, for you know, like, a qualifying offer guy, then they would lose the next. They can't, like, skirt around this. Like, they're going to lose two first round, two second round picks one way or the other. And if it just so happens that they sign a qualifying offer guy and lose a pick this year or next year, then that just kicks the can down the road. So they lose, and, like, they lose the 2022 pick at that point. But that's a pretty tangible thing. Like, Fangraphs has a thing where Craig Edwards last April had a, like, a valuation tool, just sort of trying to reduce like a future value of picks back to, like, present day value. And given where the Astros pick, assuming they're still going to be really good the next couple of years, their pick's going to be, like, near the bottom of the first and second rounds. But, like, even that, those four picks are worth, like, a total of probably between $25 and $30 million in net present value. So that's, like, a huge thing. Plus, it's, you lose development time. You're technically lose, like, part of your signing bonus pool. So even though you don't have the picks, it hampers your ability to get, like, overvalue guys later because you don't have the money to pay them without significant penalties. So that's like a big loss. Also, AJ Hinch, their manager, Jeff Luhnow, their general manager, were both suspended by MLB for a year. It's actually through the end of the World Series. So, but then, like, the day it came out, the Astros owner, Jim Crane, fired both of them. They were both under contract for a few more years. So, like that's one of those things where, wow, okay, that was kind of stunning, because it's like, okay, these guys' reputations are damaged. Then, like, okay, so back to the players thing, right? There's no MLB said they're not going to fine any players. Their logic was, or at least in the report, it's impossible to determine exactly to, like, suss out which players did what. And but this was they defined it as a player-driven scheme, with the exception of bench coach Alex Cora.
that guy.
And so the only reason Alex Cora didn't get disciplined yet by MLB is because there's a current investigation going on to the 2018 Red Sox, of which he was a manager. I saw something. I think Rob Bradford of WEEI in Boston reported data. I think that finding, or, like, that report's due out in, like, maybe the first couple weeks of February. So we'll get that. And it seems like the way this is set up, that Alex Cora is going to get the hammer, right? Like, the biggest hammer of all. But then, to sort of get back to this, the Red Sox, the day after the report came out, fired Alex Cora. So, like there's reverberations. Also, no players were mentioned specifically in the report except one, Carlos Beltran, who was in his last year and was, as, like, noted as a like a key person in the running of things, and, like, he was hired to manage the Mets, and then the Mets fired him before he even managed a game. So, like, there's fallout of this, right? Like, the weird thing is, like, MLB basically asked players. They asked teams, they put a gag order on teams, it was clear. the Dodgers actually released a statement, which is like the most passive aggressive, petty like statement. I mean, I'm gonna read it to you verbatim. Quote, all clubs have been asked by Major League Baseball not to comment on today's punishment of the Houston Astros, as it's inappropriate to comment on discipline imposed on another club. The Dodgers have also been asked not to comment on any wrongdoing during the 2017 World Series and will have no further comment at this time.
The Dodgers like, have been asked to not comment on the Astros being dirty, dirty cheaters.
Right. It's like, oh, by the way, did we mention that we lost the 2017 World Series being cheaters? Like, it's like the – it was – that statement made me laugh really hard. And like, so yeah, that's where we're at. And so, but MLB, you know, can't really put a gag order on players. And there's been a lot of players like outspoken, like, you know, going like, why weren't these players disciplined? Like, Trevor Bauer has been taking like a victory lap, which is like a little unsettling on a, for a lot of reasons, but like, because he's been like vocal about how the Astros are cheaters for years, but usually regarding pitching stuff. And so this is usually basically regarding stealing signs and getting them for batters. So it's a little weird. Mike Clevenger of the Indians, I think, said something to the effect, like in a video, these motherfuckers can't get away with this, that kind of thing. It's just
a little bit after this, there is a little like, were the Astros wearing electronic devices on their shoulders? And that has less substantiation, but you know, rumors are milling, who knows? But I think that was the announcement where Cody Bellinger commented on it. Was it on Twitter or on Instagram?
Twitter.
Just about how their players need to be punished. That was the case. And had he signed it this time when Alex Wood commented? I think he had, right?
Yes.
It was right after old friend Alex Wood, who we're going to talk about a little bit, commented that he would rather face a player on steroids than a batter who knew what was coming.
Right. And so, and a lot of players were like, you know, chiming in on that and saying they agree. And like noted, like, discipline pro Justin Verlander, who was very outspoken when he was with the Tigers on sign stealing and domestic violence like abusers, notably silent so far as a member of the Astros. So yeah, good times. The Astros are like literally baseball's heel right now. They had a fan fest over the weekend, and like Alex Bregman had one of the lamest like interviews I've ever seen. Like he was being asked about it, and he said, MLB did their report. The Astros did what they did. And then he had this like canned statement, which was just total BS. And he kept saying it over and over again to like every single question. So like they're acting like this is still like, I guess, allegations, when in fact it's clear now that they are officially cheaters, right? Like that's like, it's on record, right? That's so, I don't understand why you can't like address that part of it, right? So they're heels, they're going to get booed everywhere they go. And it's going to be interesting how this falls out. And I'm very interested to see what the Red Sox thing happens, because Alex Cora was, okay, so back to the punishment for a second. Baseball basically said about A.J. Hinch, didn't really know what was going on. A.J. Hinch was wishy-washy, too, because he's like, hey, I don't really condone this. He tried to, like, he smashed, like, the monitor or something, like, two different occasions trying to indicate his displeasure. Yet he's the manager. He still let it go on under his watch, so that's why he got suspended and then obviously fired. They said Jeff Luna didn't have much like any knowledge of this, so he wasn't, but just the fact that he oversaw such a rampant like misuse of rules, like that's why he was gone. Alex Cora, they're like, no, he was part of it, like he was clearly part of it. So I think based on Astro stuff alone, I think he's gonna get suspended for longer than a year, because that's what those two guys got. So if there's anything in the Red Sox report too, he could get like, I don't know if it's going to be a lifetime ban or something like that, but it's going to be huge. And like the key thing now is like, you know, technically, I guess Cora will probably get suspended for the season, but Carlos Beltran can technically sign somewhere to manage or coach. It's interesting to see once the year suspension is up for Hinch, once Cora's suspension is up, will these guys get hired again. I think they eventually will, but it's going to be interesting to see how they're, if they're treated as like pariahs, or like, how can you trust these people? Or if it's more of a PR thing, like, I think that's more of it. Like, owners just don't want to deal with that. Like, especially now they're kind of toxic. So, but that's, what happened in the Dodgers. They're at the very least like lost to one team. Oh, the report did say that the Astros cheated into or stole signs into the 2017 postseason. So not just the regular season, but into the postseason, that includes the World Series. So officially the Dodgers lost to a cheating team then. And did they lose to one in 2018 as well? Nothing you can really do about the past, but you just hope that MLB has a thing going forward where it makes it more difficult for this to happen.
All right. You want to move on?
Yep.
Alex Wood. I correctly predicted by me 2 weeks ago.
And they they signed him at a huge discount.
That's like, right. I had him at $50 million for 1 year, just so they would hit the threshold, the tax threshold.
He got sort of a Kenta Maeda light contract, $4 million guaranteed, 1 year deal. He can earn up to $6 million in bonuses. There's part of that's innings, part of it's like appearances, but instead of like a lot of old like contract incentives had either games or starts, his is games, but they're appearances of 10 plus outs. So I think this is like, I don't know if this is going to be the standard going forward, but I think it's like, it's language to like avoid, like if your team uses an opener and like, you're the bulk guy after, like, so it's a way to sort of like, look, I'm really the starter, like that kind of a thing. And I think that's the expectation at least, but it's just interesting wrinkle how that was written. The thing with Wood last year, like he only made 7 starts with the Reds. He was bad. Like he allowed 11 home runs in just under 36 innings. So, and like, keep in mind in his 4 full seasons with the Braves and the Dodgers, like, he allowed 16, 15, 15, and 14 home runs, all of those in seasons over 150 innings pitched. So, like, to allow 11 home runs in that few of innings, something was off. He had a back injury in spring training. He didn't really pitch for the Reds till late July. He was scratched September 3rd with lower back soreness again, then shut down for the season. So it was like a lost season in Cincinnati for him. But looking now, he's back with the Dodgers. So we'll see how that goes.
You and I, when Alex was on the Dodgers, you and I were little stands for him, right? Like, we always kind of had his back as a very reasonable option. I think during 2017, as a worthy contributor, as the fourth starter, which he proved us correctly on. Another pitcher, this is my segue, that I have been standing for a little bit the previous season. No longer on the Dodgers. Casey Sadler designated for assignment and then traded to the Cubs.
Yeah, ERA plus, near champion. Obviously, nobody can compete with Russell Martin, but Casey Sadler had a good year in limited time with the Dodgers, even if the peripherals didn't necessarily suggest that it was sustainable, but he did what he did, and he was good. He also was, I believe, optioned. It was either 9 or 10 different times last year, up and down to the minors. So I always sort of have a soft spot for those kind of guys, because that's an insane year, right, to go through that. But then, so they traded Casey Sadler to the Cubs, and then they got an infielder. His name is Clayton Daniels. So the Dodgers have another Clayton,
and not a double first name.
That's right. And as we've shown, people with two first names are very trustworthy.
And
yeah, exactly. But this guy, he was a 31st round pick in 2018. He's old, though. Turns 25 in May. He played single A and double A last year, only 67 games. He had a good on base percentage. He hit 305 with 397 on base, more walks and strikeouts. Infielder, mostly second, some short, a little bit of third. Not much to see there, I don't think, but yeah, that's who they got for Casey Sadler. One more note on Wood. The Astros only lost one home game in the 2017 postseason, where they sort of had their system in place at home of stealing signs. And the one game they lost was started by Alex Wood, game four of the World Series.
Who noted that he was changing his signs up every eight or so pitches, I think he said.
Yes, yep, exactly.
Under suspicion. And I wish he had told Yu Darvish to do the same. You might have been tipping his pitches in other ways. Who knows? I love Yu Darvish. He's been I've followed him since he was a star in Japan. We've talked about it here before. I'm sad for him, and especially so after these revelations.
He's also handled like his sort of failure in that World Series with as good as I've ever seen anybody mm-hmm. handle it. And like he's been like great. So yeah, always. We'll always sort of root for him as a person, and a baseball player. So, yeah, perfect.
Well, we've got some business to take care of, but then we're going to talk the business of baseball, arbitration, one of your favorite subjects, I know. I
Yay.
Think you have an extremely mean trivia question for me regarding arbitration that I am going to fail horribly at, all that after this. So I confuse this every single year. I think I text you every single year about this. The deadline that just passed is for what deadline did just pass? Because the things players can still settle, players and teams can still settle, right?
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, the way salary arbitration works, like the hearings themselves, if it gets to that, are not until February, and they're not even scheduled until like closer to then, when like if it becomes clear that a player and a team still can't reach a contract. I think there were something like, I want to say, was it 50? 53 maybe players? I think I even wrote it in the show notes, so maybe I should just look down. I think like, there's so many players like...
52.
Yeah, 52. Okay. The date that just passed was the exchange date, which is when, you know, these teams and players have been negotiating for a little bit. Like, it's not like an ongoing thing. It's not like it takes all off season, right? But like mostly this last week that when it happens is when most of the negotiation happens. And when it gets down to it though, they both have to submit a figure, the team and the player. And then if they can't agree, up until February, then if an arbitration hearing, they each side states their case to a three-person panel, and that panel chooses one figure or the other. So the system is designed to get the team and player to meet somewhere in the middle. It doesn't always work that way. And the other thing that sort of complicates this in recent years, Andrew Friedman with the Rays did this, and the Braves were like early adopters of this, but it's become more prevalent, is file and trial or file and go. The concept that a team as a club policy, like the Dodgers have a policy of not handing out no trade clauses, right? It's not an MLB rule. It's just something they believe in. And this is similar to that. It's not a rule. Technically, teams and players can still negotiate. Generally, Andrew Friedman has been, if we can't reach an agreement by the exchange date, we will no longer negotiate and we'll proceed to a hearing. Like, you know, the premise behind it is roughly like Andrew Friedman addressed this like back when he was with the Rays. I've talked to him briefly about it since, like nothing really new there. But it's essentially like, I guess the old feeling was like, or you know, agents and teams would like game the system a little bit and try to like negotiate to get to a certain number for the exchange date and then keep negotiating for a high number. And like this, they're trying to like head that off at the pass basically and get like an actual negotiation going to where they could try to get a deal up to the point of the exchange. But it's really like when it comes down to it, it's really just stubbornness. Like some of these, like the differences are very like tiny relative mm-hmm. to like the actual salary. So like, I don't know. It's a weird thing. The Dodgers have not had an arbitration hearing at all since Joe Bimel in 2007. And we'll get to him later. But I don't know. It's weird. Like, they under Friedman, they haven't even had players exchange salaries because they've gotten to agreements with all the players by that date. This year, four players did not agree to deals just yet. So they could potentially have up to four hearings, but that's if they stick to the policy and refuse to negotiate. But we'll get to that. What they did do is sign five players sign deals. The big one obviously was Cody Bellinger, 1 year, $11.5 million. That's basically in line to what, like, I think MLB Trade Rumors had him at 11.6 as their projection. So that's a record for like a first time ARB eligible guy. He's a super two player. We talked about this before. Chris Bryant and Ryan Howard both won MVPs before their super two status, and both set records at the time. Ryan Howard made $10 million in 2008. Chris Bryant made $10.85 in 2018. And so Bellinger's at 11.5. He set that standard. So Ryan Howard made $64 million through his four ARB years. Bryant is up to about $42.3 through his three, and he has another one. Well, he also has his grievance, which is supposed to be decided relatively soon. He could technically be a free agent at the end of this year if he wins that grievance, but otherwise he'll have another ARB year next year. So, like, that's where we talked about as a possibility of, like, a Cody Bellinger contract extension, how it might look. At least we have an idea through those years. But so Bellinger's sort of on that path. Corey Seager signed 7.6. PK was $5.9 million. Stripling, $2.1 million. And then Julio Urias was $1 million. And then – so if you look at all the contracts they've signed so far – we'll get to that. I guess there's four players like who have like a midpoint in their the team and the player number. So if you count Alex Wood, and if you count the midpoints of the four who haven't yet signed, the Dodgers payroll right now, the CBT number is roughly at $173.8 million. So like, they still have another – we talked about this before. Like, Sandcastle said they're going to get to that CBT threshold or possibly above, and that's 208. How are they going to spend that other $35 million? And that's even – I even – in this case, I accounted for the minimum – roughly minimum salaries to fill out the roster. That's like accounting for, like, everything as is. So, I'm anxious to see how this goes.
And it'll be interesting. One interesting thing is that I forget what piece it was. It might have been somewhere at The Athletic. You might know. But pointing out that in the interview he said it would the roster going into the postseason would be closer to that number and more competitive. So, well, you know, perhaps the Red Sox bottom out and they at that point they're more eager to trade Mookie Betts. Perhaps the Indians do it as well. But that said, and we'll get into this probably in 2 weeks, which I think will be our spring training preview episode, barring any big news. This is looking more and more like the team they're taking in the spring training and looking like your opening day roster.
Yeah, the other thing is like that not that many people are left. Teams in terms of free agents. Josh Donaldson signed with the Twins. Just an update on the Red Sox thing. I believe it was Buster Olney who reported this on Sunday that the asking price for the Red Sox for Mookie Betts was that they would take on either, I believe, David Price or possibly Nathan Eovaldi's contract, and with like little to no money paid down. So you're basically taking on that and two like high level prospects. So That's definitely where like the scuttlebutt is. If in any sort of Dodgers trade talks, like they're not going to give up like Gavin Lux, right? In any of those deals, especially if they have to take on David Price. But like it's just a matter of haggling over what those two prospects would be. So like you can see why no real trade has happened.
But maybe that goes down to one A-minus tier prospect. You know, if the deal happens more like July than right now, who knows? Yeah. Right. I don't know. And a lot of that will depend on how much leverage the Dodgers feel they have, depending on how the Red Sox are doing. So
yeah, we'll see. another one of those things too. Like, you remember, like, they would still, I think, I don't know. Like, keep in mind mid-season additions, right? You're basically July trade deadline. It's basically a third of the season. So even Mookie Betts, who I believe is making, what is he? He's either 27 or 28 million. I can't remember the exact number. Even that, you're looking at 9 to 9.3 million in taking him on the rest of the season. And I guess David Price would be roughly that. So even if they happen to add Price and Betts, like on July 31st, like that doesn't quite get them. Yeah. They still have 15 million more to spend.
And in the interview, he did backtrack. He's like, we'll be well over it. We're a little close to it.
It's
like,
okay, close to all it, right, Stan. Yeah. But that's the level of deal they'd have to do to get there. So, like, there's a lot of creativity still to be had. I'm not going to go over the details of the arm numbers, but the four players unsigned, Joc Pederson, Chris Taylor, Max Muncy, Pedro Baez, the smallest percentage difference in between the team and the player is Baez. He submitted 4 million. The Dodgers had 3.5. So the difference there is a 14.3% difference. I went back and looked through every instance of the Dodgers in arbitration. There's been 20 cases. The arbitration started like in the 70s. It happened a little before free agency. The first case they ever had was Ron Say in 1974. And keep in mind, like, what was his thing? He wanted 56,000 and the Dodgers countered at 47,000 to give you an idea of what the stakes were at the time, like how different it is. And like, and he won that case. So that was the smallest difference percentage wise in Dodger, like, arbitration history. If any of these cases go to an arbitration hearing, they'll, two of them are smaller than that. Like, Baez's difference is 14%. Max Muncy's difference is 16.9. Oh, I'm sorry. I was incorrect. Chris Taylor actually has the smallest difference. He's 10.5%. So he requested 5.8. The Dodgers are 5.25. So we're talking like, it's one thing to say, like, 550,000 is like no big deal, but it kind of isn't. Like, in this, like, you'd think they could meet somewhere in the middle, but if they're stubborn enough to go to a hearing, it's over a relatively small amount. So we'll see how that goes. But that's sort of where the Dodgers are at right now.
So you mentioned it. The Dodgers haven't done this in 12 years. Is that right?
13.
Oh, it's 2020 now. Did you? Happy New Year, Eric.
Right.
I saw you on New Year's Day. And I somewhere buried in here was it, you highlight in red in our show notes anytime you're going to ask me a mean trivia question. And I know that's somewhere in there. What you got for me?
Okay, so before I say that, Joe Bimbo, we'll get to him. He's actually at Dodgers Rewind, spoiler alert. He was the last time they went to a salary arbitration. That was 07. They almost did with Andre Ethier in 2009, getting back to the system again. He had submitted a number. The Dodgers, he submitted 3.7. The Dodgers wanted 2.65 million. Just before they were going to go in their hearing, literally at the building itself, I think in Phoenix, the two sides reached an agreement on 3.1 million, just shy of the midpoint that year. That's like an extreme case of like, close to the line, but like that's generally how it sort of goes in this. We'll see if that happens. But yeah, my question to you. So the Dodgers have had, they've had 20 arbitration hearings in their history. I mentioned that. There's actually only been 7 in the last 30 years. So like and only 3 this century. Can you name the last Dodger to win an arbitration hearing against the club?
Okay, so am I correct in that this is pre-Kim Ng?
Yes.
Okay. Was it in the 90s?
It was not.
Oh, crap. was it in the 80s?
It was not, although I could tell you the last Dodger to win before this person was Oral Hershiser in 1986.
So that was going to be my guess, so... No, I'm not gonna. You're talking before I was born, Eric. Am I correct in saying that?
No. Because you said if it was in the 90s, and I said the last person before this was 1986. So it's actually sooner than that.
Okay. Sorry, I thought we were going even earlier. I misunderstood.
No.
You. Yeah. So it was one of the it's before Kim Ean, but in this century.
Yes.
Okay. That's where I was getting misled. Okay. So crap. let's see. Yeah, I need one more hint.
Huh. I'm trying to think.
Some of this is a stall tactic while I think of a clever name.
Oh man. Do you remember? I believe his name was Jose Nunez. He was a Rule 5 pick from the Padres. Do you remember him at all?
Vaguely.
This player who won the arbitration hearing a few years earlier was very vocal against having such a raw and inexperienced pitcher pitching in games that matter for the Dodgers that April.
No, I'm tapping out. You got me.
Terry Adams.
Okay, yeah, 0%. Yeah, not a name that was going to come from my Rolodex, so I'm glad we skipped that.
2001, he was like a swingman for them.
So 2001 and 2002, those were the years where I stopped getting upset that baseball was on instead of like The Simpsons or something. And I'm like, fine, I'm going to watch this. And I slowly learned the name. Learning the name Paul Quantrill was the moment where I realized I liked baseball. So before my time of expert precision paying attention. So kudos, Terry Adams, you stumped me.
Ha. Okay. So that's good.
So what else should we know about arbitration week before we sort of move on? We'll have updates, like you said, on those four players on whether or not it's at an actual hearing, which would be I hate the idea of arbitration. I get why it's in place, but it feels like an arbiter should also just be able to pick the middle number as opposed to just pick one of the two sides. So I hope they settle just because it feels like no one wins when it goes to a trial. Sure, the team is saving tiny, tiny amounts of cents, but the players, I would assume, feel bad because we talked about this. Because most of the time, when a hearing occurs, it is just the team telling the player and their agent why they think they suck, why they don't think they're as valuable as they think they are, and that's not good.
It can be very caustic, but like also at the same time, it's pretty professional too. Like not everyone takes it personally. Sure. I looked up the numbers. The 52 players was actually, it could be for the last 3 years. So this year, 20 players exchanged numbers, which is still a high number. However, like I think part of this has to do with like the looming like CBA, sure. And like the players are like gearing up for fighting basically. And so in a weird, like in an odd, it's like more of a solidarity type thing than anything, I think, players are like tired of, sort of accepting what the algorithm says they're worth, I think. And we've seen that in a lot of free agent cases the last couple of years where certain players, they happen to say get like three contract offers that were almost identical, like on like the same day. And then, you know, when some of the collusion talk was going around and it's like, all right, like, we're tired of this. Like, where's the actual free market part of the free market? Again, arbitration, not on the free market, but same sort of process. But yeah, so like, if you look at it, if George Springer, this ties into the cheating. So he had one of the larger numbers. Like, I think his was like 22 and a half million and 17 million or 17 and a half million were the two numbers they submitted. And I think he agreed at somewhere in the middle. I forgot the exact number, but the AP story on George Springer, like agreeing to a contract with the Astros was George Springer, World Series MVP of the tainted 2017 Houston Astros, comma, like did this. I'm like, wow. Okay. So that's like, it's canon now that the Astros cheated in 2015. But so I think like, but if you look, you know, so recent years, I went and looked this up there were a single digit number of arbitration hearings in 12 out of 13 years from 2005 to 2017. There were zero hearings in 2013. So the system was like working, like you don't, player, they're finding ways to in the middle to like new contracts. 2018, there were 22 hearings. 2019, there were 10. This year, there's probably going to be like 10-ish or more. So, like, that's a sign that the players are, like, willing to fight. That's kind of all I got on this, but we'll see how that sort of happens. I'd like to think that the Dodgers aren't, like, so beholden to this, like, policy that they wouldn't still negotiate, especially with some of the differences being so small. But that's kind of where we're at, and we'll see exactly how that happens.
Okay, we've got Dodgers Rewind already spoiled. Joe Bimel, who I'm very excited to talk about, bobblehead recipient. I own his bobblehead somewhere. Hopefully my mom didn't give it away. And then we've got questions from Craig after this last commercial break. Joe Bimel, what a hero.
He is. He really was. I sort of remember him for his robe. He had the Dodgers jersey robe that, like, had Bimel 97 on the back. Like, it looked like a jersey, except it was a robe. Like, it was a great piece. I think he had it, like, celebrating going to the playoffs in 06, I believe he was wearing it. So he was the last Dodger to go to an arbitration hearing. It was February 2007. That was when Kim Ng was the assistant general manager, and she sort of handled all that stuff. Her most famous arb case was Eric Gagne, who, right after Eric Gagne won the Cy Young, he asked for like $5 million, or I'm sorry, he asked for $8 million. The team went for $5 million. Like, that's a huge difference. Like, that's the normal kind of spread we see in this. And the Kim Ng argued for the club, and her argument was like too much too soon, like in terms of his service time and stuff. The team won that case. They also won the case against Joe Bimel. Bimel asked for $1.25 million. He was a lefty reliever, and the club offered $912,500, and the team won that case. So he pitched for the Dodgers for a few years. He had in three parts of 3 years, 3.04 ERA, 145 ERA plus, so pretty good, 3.78 FIP. He third in the NL with 83 games pitched in 2007. 83. He was the last Dodger to appear in 80 or more games. There's only been four other LA Dodgers to pitch in that many games in a season. How many of those can you name?
So I'm proud and embarrassed by one of these names because during our commercial break, I actually did Google his name, not because I wanted to make sure I was right before I said it, but because I didn't want to get the name wrong. I think I was afraid of saying Gary Marshall instead of Mike Marshall, so I had to double check myself. But I think somewhere in my brain was lodged where we talked about like Ironman relievers before, and that was lodged in my brain, even though it does very much predate my knowledge pool.
So these are happy days indeed. you're welcome. Because, yes, Mike Marshall was one of them. And I should correct myself. It's not LA Dodgers. It's Dodgers.
No. Oh, cool. Screw you.
nobody in Brooklyn ever pitched 80 games.
Oh, okay. That's what I was gonna say. You're going to find some. I know it's not Three Finger Brown.
Oh, no, yes, I was. Yeah, it's Addy Joss or something like that. No, Mike Marshall, 106 games. Still the record for any reliever. 208 and a third innings as a reliever in 1974. Just ridiculous, right? He finished 83 games. What an amazing year that was. Okay. So the hint I will give you, one of the other three Dodgers to pitch in 80 or more games did so the same year as Joe Bimel and pitched in the same number of games.
Okay, so that's interesting. So one name I was going to throw out that I think is wrong, but I wanted to say the name. Speaking of players that I kind of learned how I learned baseball, Guillermo Mota.
Nope. Okay. He was a part of that incredible 2003.
Yeah, and I seem to recall like he was like one of the workhorse kind of guys, but
he was. He pitched over 100 innings, but two other pitchers on that staff, not Eric Gagne, I'll give you another hint, they did 80 or more games.
Okay.
It's all been this century, the other three.
I'm giving myself just a little bit of time to to think.
If you had to just off the top of your head, I say 2007 Dodgers reliever. Who would you say?
Are we in like Brazoban area at that time? Oh wait, hold on.
No, it's a little bit after Brazoban.
Okay. Hunchy Kuo?
No, he was never like durable enough.
I know. No, I was answering your previous question on who, if I just had to say a name. So no, okay. I'm tapping
I'm
out.
I'm trying to steer you towards the next answer. Okay. Let's see. Hunchy Kuo's best season the most innings he ever pitched was 80. That was in a year where he had 42 games. His high games was 56. Okay, so the other pitchers who threw in 80 games, Jonathan Broxton in 2007, 83 sure. games also. Tom Martin, the left-handed specialist on the 2003 Dodgers, appeared
in
80
That's kind
games.
Of the area I was trying to enter into. I'm like, who was the loogie on that team? And I now that you say the name, absolutely. But yeah, I wasn't going to get to it.
Yeah. That bullpen was ridiculous. Like that, they were so good. And then the other player on that team did it actually 2 years in a row, led the National League in games in both 2002 and 2003, Paul Quantrill, 86 games and then 89 games.
Gosh darn it. Why didn't I go with him? I'm so upset with myself now. Like I literally mentioned him 20 minutes ago and I just couldn't pull the trigger.
Yeah. So that, there's my second hard Jacob trivia question. I'm sure I'm going to, although I don't think Craig actually asked us trivia this time. So, but yeah, anyway, back to Bimal for a second. The other thing was notable. He was on the 2006 NLDS roster, but then had to be removed. Like the Dodgers opened that series in New York and they, like everybody was angry about the double play at home plate play. But I think Joe Bimal took it one step further. He had a cut on his hand the day before game one. He first said he injured himself in his hotel room. It was revealed 2 days later that he injured his hand in a bar in New York. I looked this up. So in the ESPN story on this, I think it was possibly the AP report, Bimal apologized to his teammates. Jason Repko, of all people, was on record in this. He said, he's going to pay for what he did, but I think it was good for to be up front with us. Even though it was a little late, at least he said something. And this is just a reminder that Jason Repko was on the Dodgers playoff roster. And he appeared to one game as a pinch runner in game one in that series to give you an idea of what kind of what we were talking about with the Dodgers back then. Joe Bimal also went to arbitration with the Dodgers in 2008. This time they were it was $2.15 million versus $1.7 million. This time they both teams said, we don't want to go to a hearing. They settled at exactly the midpoint. So Joe Bimal didn't want to go through the process, or they just agreed to agree. And that's it. So that's the last Dodgers arbitration hearing. It's very likely that they're going to have at least one, if not four, this February. But that's Joe Bimal.
Okay. It's time for
questions from Craig.
Five and a half questions. He snuck a secret one in the last question, but I'll let it pass. But the first question for both of us: pitchers and catchers are reporting in less than a month. Dodger Fan Fest is this Saturday, and the Dodgers could have their first arbitration hearing since 2007. With that, here are the questions. Justin Turner is the only Dodger who will be 35 during the 2020 season. Will there be any other player to join him on this season's roster? And if so, will he be a position player or a pitcher? Bonus for Jacob, do you keep track of baseball players older than you? You know, I hadn't, you know, had that sense of dread of my mortality, but now I do. Thanks, Craig.
Yeah, and so because Craig asked you that, I looked this up because I had always sort of forgotten just exactly who was the last. Bartolo Colon still being active in 2018 and Ichiro too made it so there were an MLB player older than I am, which was great. And then Ichiro technically played in 2019, so So there hasn't been a major league season with a player with no players older than me yet. But this season, it's looking like it's going to happen. But from a Dodger standpoint, the last year that there was a Dodger older than me was 2016 with Joel Peralta. That March, actually on my birthday, I believe, in spring training, Jamie Wright was trying to make a comeback, and he announced his retirement. He would have also been older. He would have been the last Dodger. He was the last Dodger before Peralta, who was older than me in 2014, and then before that it was Ted Lilly. So, like, I irrationally was rooting for those guys to stick around forever because didn't want to, like.
How much older than Chase Utley are you?
Good question. I believe he's a 1980 birthday, but I'm going to look it up. And I'm 76.
78. So,
oh, yeah. So 2 years, two okay. years apart. So, yeah. Depending on how I grow my beard out, I can also be the silver fox in a way. So, like, I'm sort of proud. But to Craig's question, will my inclination on this will, so like David, the Dodgers lost Rich Hill, David Freese, and man, I'm blanking on who their other old person was. I had this last year. And Russell Martin were the three guys, 36, 36, and 39. So like, I was looking at this, like, I don't think they're going to like have a player 35 or older. Just looking at like the people available, it just doesn't seem like no free agents right now. Or I mean, there's a couple. I was trying to think of someone they might trade for, like a David Freese type. But I was looking at this list of like players in 2019 who were 34 or older, and I just sorted it by OPS plus in like 150 plate appearances or more. Like the name that stands out to me as maybe the most likely is Matt Joyce. But he's a left-handed pitcher. Left-handed batter, who has like limited. He can't really play center field, and he's like not that good of a defender on the corners. So like he really has to hit to have value. And given that the Dodgers have other like outfield options, he's a free agent right now. Like that's a reach. I do wonder about what the 26-man roster, like if there's going to be more likely to have like almost a straight pinch hitter person who doesn't necessarily have to have value, but I still think the Dodgers would want a guy with some defensive versatility, and not being able to play center probably knocks him out of that. The other on this list was like John Jay, who could potentially play like all three outfield positions, but like he's been bad offensively for a while. And like at his best, he's like an on-base guy. But I think the ship has sailed on that. And John Jay is going to be 35 this year too. So, other than that, like it's really tough to see.
I could see kind of like a non-roster invitee pitcher making a start. Older person. And I have a name in mind for that position. I don't know; it would be bittersweet for you. How about a little Edwin Jackson?
Well, look, I'm on board.
You want him to go into another team. I'm aware.
A team's
never been on before.
The way I look at it, every time Edwin Jackson is pitching in a major league game, he is auditioning himself for his next team.
That's fair.
So like anything that keeps Edwin Jackson alive in the majors is fine by me.
Second question. Will the 49ers score more points in the Super Bowl than the number of wins the Golden State Warriors will have at the end of the season?
So... okay, let's just say I think that it's going to be the Niners because, like, the Warriors probably top out at, like, 25 wins probably.
Steph is coming back, you know.
That's fine.
At some point for, like, a month maybe.
But I think this is going to be, like, a fairly high-scoring Super Bowl. I think it's reasonable to think the Niners will score at least, like, 24 points, right? And I think they have the potential to score, like, 28 and more. So I would take the Niners just in general in this question. I'd go with the Niners. Pretty easy for me.
Would you remove team officials from the video replay booth and have MLB personnel handle it from this point forward?
Okay, so this gets back to the Astros punishment where you know, it's, they didn't punish any players. Like, how couldn't you punish any players? But the key to me going is how MLB handles this going forward. And like, it's tough because like you have to come up with something now for like this year to make it where like there's not like a question going into every game like, hey, is this team cheating, right? Like, that's a huge problem for the sport. So I think the most extreme example of this, which I was sort of initially like in favor of, I think, is just to make it where teams could challenge for a replay, but they have to do it blind. Like, they can't call to their video room and say, hey, what do we see on that play, right? Like, that's the general process now. You wait for a few seconds, and then they look and say, you know, challenge it or don't challenge it. I think you – that's, like, the extreme example. However, I guess the solution, like a temporary – or maybe it's permanent – is to make sure there's always an MLB official – in the video room, whether it's like a dedicated room in the home side of the club of the clubhouse, or in some makeshift area where on the visitor side where that team is. The problem is it's not universal in every stadium, like how it's set up. But so I think as long as there's like an MLB official there to like monitor what's going in and out, you can probably keep the old replay system. But yeah, like, and also they could probably, the MLB official will be able to enforce things like making sure that all videos like into like the clubhouse or the areas around the clubhouse or between the dugout and the clubhouse are like on delay, which is what's supposed to happen. It didn't happen with the Astros. So I don't know exactly how this gets policed, but I think that's going to be how MLB handles this. Is like the issue they really have to deal with going forward to sort of regain that confidence back in like the actual competition itself.
Are there any players besides Bonds, Clemens, and maybe Manny that you two saw play that are eligible and are not in the Hall of Fame, but should be in the Hall of Fame?
So I was thinking about this, like the first player that came to mind, and I didn't really look this up, but I did now, but like it was Kenny Lofton. He was like the fact that he got like a shamefully low amount of support. He was one and done on the Hall of Fame ballot 2013, 3.2%. Almost no matter how you slice it, like he was an excellent player. Like just I don't necessarily agree that like let's just, you know, make this a war leaderboard in the Hall of Fame, but he amassed 68 war in his career. Like that's huge. He stole 600 bases. He was a preeminent like leadoff guy. He got on base. He had a reasonable amount of power. He hit triples more than, you know, a little bit less than home runs, but like he was an impact player, like defensively on the bases, hitting. I think it Kenny Lofton for me, like, definitely deserved a lot more consideration than he got. Like, I would vote for him. I think that I ever will because he's no longer on the writer's ballot. But I think he's a guy, like, when he was playing, he was an absolute, like, star. He was in a lot of commercials, especially with, like, Nike and, like, you know, it was, like, him and Ken Griffey Jr. and some other players. So, like, I think Kenny Lofton, for me, is the one that stood out. Other than that, off the top of my head that I watched play, oh, probably Fred McGriff. I think, like, you know, he suffers from being like in the steroid era, but like, I think a lot of his, like, he had some awesome years, like late 80s into the early 90s, where he was just really good. And like, I sort of wonder about, like, he just finished shy of 500 homers. I don't know if it necessarily would have got in if he got the seven more home runs that he needed, but it's just one of those things. Like, I think he was excellent. So like, that was a guy I thought was a Hall of Famer. Like, I could see the argument one way or the other with him, but like, he's probably a guy I would highly consider voting for too.
The only couple of names that I'd throw out there, I think Mark McGwire is a biased for me, because I was at the game he hit the ball out at Dodger Stadium. So nice. Outside of the sort of national moment, that was always a special moment for me. And the name that of a player that I watched sort of toward the tail end of his career, but always thought was like two players that were like this, Lance Berkman. He doesn't have the numbers. He doesn't for the Hall of Fame, but he was one of those players that, as I was watching, I always thought this guy through that 3 or 4 year period is one of the 2 or 3 best hitters in baseball, but just never got that sort of reputation, and later became kind of a gentleman I'm not rooting for exactly. So not heartbroken there, but Scott Rowland is the other name that I've always thought like deserved just maybe I'm not necessarily he for sure is should be a Hall of Famer, but should get a little bit more talk than maybe he normally would.
Yeah, I think, yeah, he's definitely there. Like, so right now, like, as we're recording this, the Hall of Fame announcement's coming out Tuesday. This will be out, I imagine, just after that. Derek Jeter's going to get elected, and it's going to be close to whether Larry Walker and maybe Curt Schilling is like those are the two are like closest to getting in. I don't think either one gets in, but it'll be close. But Scott Rowland is on his third year in the ballot, and he's the biggest gainer so far this year. He's using the tracker from Ryan Thibodeau on Twitter, and he has a few other people like sort of helping him compile all the ballots that writers publicly reveal. So through 198 ballots that are known, a little less than probably half of what the total vote's going to be, Roland's at 50%. So that's something to like build on in future years. So like he's plus 49 votes over last year, given like writers that have like changed their mind on him. So I think if he sort of continues that support, he'll eventually get in. So this is going to be my fifth year, I believe, in the BBWAA. So like it's going to be a close call, but like there's a very slight chance that Rowland could still be on the ballot by the time I would potentially get a Hall of Fame vote. So maybe I do get to vote for Scott Rowland, and I think I would.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
The final question and a half. Food. Jacob, which barbecue meats should you have at your Super Bowl party, given that Kansas City is playing? And Eric, besides your stuffed mushrooms, what other appetizers are great on the table? I'm going to let you go first.
Okay, so Craig listed 3 examples, but the first one was deviled eggs. Hell no. I hate deviled eggs with a passion. They're the worst. They are, yeah. So I don't, like, stuffed mushrooms are a go-to. Buffalo wings are great. Pretty simple, like a chip and a dip, spinach dip he listed too, 7-layer dip. Those are all wonderful. Those are like the sort of go-to for me, like on a Super Bowl Sunday. Like, I believe I am not going to the SB Nation home office, but a bunch of our football people are, and I think the social team is as well. And I believe they're going to order a crap load of Popeyes and go to town on that. So like that's also good. Like something like that, a pizza obviously is good. And depending on the party, like multiple pizzas obviously. But yeah, so if I had to pick one, it's probably buffalo wings. But yeah, what do you think?
So I'll represent the Kansas City side, as you know, the town. It is really strange to me that as a Dodger fan that I'm going to see the potentially Kansas City get 2 different kinds of championships before I see a World Series win in my lifetime versus the 7 years I've been here. But this town is fired up. They're very excited. It's an exciting, not only one, they're in the Super Bowl. It's a very exciting team to watch. I actually have watched a few full football games this playoffs, which is kind of unusual for me.
Mm-hmm.
But on the food. So the Kansas City is sort of interesting in the barbecue world in that, one, it is the best barbecue, but two, it doesn't actually have like a particular style. It's kind of a mishmash of all, basically we've stolen from the rest of the regions of the country and have made the best versions of any particular thing. But that said, I think Kansas City gets associated with 2 kind of caveats or wrinkles. We're definitely known for the sort of standard barbecue sauce, that ketchup-based kind of molasses-y barbecue sauce. And on top of that is the dish burnt ends, which are the charred ends of a smoked brisket.
Excellent.
That said, it is difficult to make burnt ends the right way. And so if you want, the best barbecue, in my mind, in Kansas City is Joe's Kansas City Barbecue, and they will deliver. They will deliver you burnt ends. They'll deliver you ribs. And if you want to be like Paul Rudd does this for his fantasy football league, I think every year, they ship their very famous, world famous Z-Man sandwich in a kit. They'll ship it right to you. So that's the way I would go. That may end up being a little pricey. So if you wanted to just kind of do your own barbecue meats, but still have something authentic, definitely get some Joe's Kansas City barbecue sauce at your Super Bowl party.
We'd like to thank our sponsor this week, Joe's Kansas City Barbecue.
Man, they should. I have sent a lot of people that way, but granted, so have a lot of other people.
I think so too. They should. I agree with you 100%. We should both get burnt ends and their Z-Man sandwich. Send it our way. Come on, Joe's. I'm just thinking too,
I'm a mile away, so I'm going to probably be having some. But
you could, in a weird twist also, you could be in Kansas City to see a San Francisco team beat Kansas City for a championship twice. Either way, it's going to be a very odd situation. But we'll talk about that next time, because when we record again, the Super Bowl will have been played. And we will know which of Joe Montana's former teams is the new champion. But we'll probably have some baseball stuff to talk about, too. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.